Good afternoon and welcome to the January meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout on the Midcoast of Maine, and a particularly warm welcome to our radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum. Since 1983, we just celebrated our 30th anniversary. The forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of the Foreign Service or academia, international businessmen or journalists, talk about critical foreign policy issues facing the United States, and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website, midcoastforum.org. Today, we're delighted to have as our speaker, Greg Thielman, a senior fellow at the Arms Control Association. Greg began his Washington career as a foreign service officer. He served for 25 years. Was political military affairs officer in both Bonn and Moscow. After retiring from the Foreign Service, he worked on the Hill as senior professional staffer of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. In 2009, he joined the Arms Control Association. He's here today. Well, unfortunately, he's not. I was hoping he was going to be here today with his daughter, Emily, who lives in Portland. And as a matter of fact, his daughter was the one who got in touch with me to tell me about Greg. So we're delighted that he could come up and battle the warm weather and rain. His very timely topic, the Iran nuclear negotiations. What's a realistic outcome? Greg.
Thank you, Mac. I'm very honored to be invited by the Midcoast Forum to discuss with you an issue of war and peace at a critical tipping point in its evolution. It's a particular pleasure to come to Maine for this discussion, even in January. Growing up in Iowa, I never appreciated what going to Maine in the summer means psychologically for those living on the east coast of the U.S. My initiation into this ritual began when I married the daughter of two Mainers from Aroostook County. But it became a more regular thing when our own daughter moved to Maine 5 years ago this month, not drawn by a job, but because Portland seemed a good place to live. It's also a good place to visit, even in January. Now, turning to our attention to the other side of the world, I pose a question in the title of my presentation, what's a realistic outcome to our nuclear negotiations with Iran? But I'm going to postpone answering that question until I can answer two other questions. Why are our relations with Iran so bad? And why can't we agree on what the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty requires its members to do? A recent book about Iran and Turkey called Reset by Stephen Kinzer, who you'll be hearing from in a few months. There's the book cover. In this book, he opens with a story of a young American teacher in Iran. The year was 1909. Howard Baskerville was a South Dakota native and graduate of Princeton University living in Tabriz, a city in northwestern Iran. Kinzer describes how the idealistic Baskerville ended up leading a group of volunteers against a counter-revolutionary siege of the city in defense of Iran's new democracy. Tragically, Baskerville was shot dead in the attack, and to this day, he is honored in Iran as a martyr. For Kinzer, he is the perfect symbol of the shared values that bind Iranians to Americans. But Baskerville is not the only one. 2 years after his death, another American, Morgan Schuster, became Treasurer General of the Persian Empire. Democracy had been reestablished in Iran, and the Iranian parliament chose Schuster to help reform Iran's finances and organize resistance to the Russian and British occupiers of the country. Indeed, through the first half of the 20th century, America was for Iranians the model of democracy and anti-colonialism. Then came oil, exploited for the principal benefit of the British-controlled Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. It was nationalized by the Iranian government in 1951. 2 years later, working with British intelligence, the CIA engineered an overthrow of Iran's democratically elected Prime Minister, Mohammad Mossadegh. This act led to the restoration of Iran's monarchy. It was followed by strong U.S. backing of the autocratic and increasingly unpopular Shah over a 26-year period, fundamentally altering Iranians' image of the U.S. Following the 1979 Iranian Revolution, students in Tehran seized the U.S. embassy, holding its employees hostage for 444 days. Diplomatic relations between the two countries were severed, a condition which has lasted now for 35 years. During the first turbulent months of the new Islamic Republic, Iran was invaded by Saddam Hussein's Iraq. The United States reacted passively to this act of aggression at first, but later in the 8-year war, gave aid and diplomatic support to Saddam, judging him the lesser of the two evils. This support continued even in the face of Iraq's heavy use of outlawed chemical weapons against Iranian soldiers and the civilians of both Iran and Iraq. And even after an Iraqi missile attack on an American frigate in the Persian Gulf, which killed 37 American sailors. Toward the end of this war, while defending free passage of tanker traffic through the Gulf, the U.S. Navy had multiple clashes over several months with Iranian military forces. In the course of that fighting, a U.S. cruiser misidentified an Iranian commercial airliner as an attacking military aircraft, even though it was flying on its usual flight path to Dubai. The U.S. warship launched missiles, which destroyed the aircraft, killing all 290 civilians on board. Of course, U.S. grievances against the Islamic Republic of Iran are more familiar to an American audience. Taking and holding American diplomats hostage, encouraging Hezbollah acts of terror against Israelis and Americans, hosting a Holocaust denial assembly in Tehran, providing critical support to the brutal regime of Syria's Bashar al-Assad in repressing his own people. And the most consequential grievance of all, failure to carry out in full Iran's obligations as a non-nuclear weapon state under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And yet, Stephen Kinzer argues that even today under clerical rule, quote, Iran has more in common with the United States than almost any other of its neighbors in the world's most troubled region, unquote. That the bilateral relationship is still frozen in hostility and suspicion is partly due to the unfortunate mismatch of timing between the conciliatory actions of each side toward the other. Not long after Iran provided critical diplomatic help to the U.S. following 9/11, President George W. Bush labeled Iran part of an axis of evil. Even when Iran halted its nuclear weapons program in 2003, offering voluntary restraints on its nuclear infrastructure, it continued to be shunned by Washington. When the Obama administration extended an open hand toward Iran in the spring of 2009, it was soon followed by the brutal suppression of Iranian demonstrators in the wake of a fraudulent presidential election. Later that year, the U.S. devised an ingenious plan to provide nuclear fuel plates for the Tehran research reactor so that it could continue producing medical isotopes in exchange for part of Iran's low-enriched uranium stockpile, which was a source of proliferation concern. This fuel swap offer was first accepted by Iran's negotiators, then rejected. But this year, we had a pleasant surprise in Iran's presidential election with a first-round choice of Hassan Rouhani, a cleric closely tied in ruling circles, tied to ruling circles, but running on a promise of reconciliation with the West and an end to the diplomatic impasse over Iran's nuclear program. The serious diplomatic efforts by Rouhani and his foreign ministry team have been reciprocated by Iran's six negotiating partners, the United States, Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China, sometimes known as the P5 plus one. These efforts yielded a joint plan of action on November 24th, which features a six-month interim agreement and a framework for negotiating a comprehensive nuclear agreement by the end of this year. The purpose of these negotiations is to agree on measures to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons without preventing Iran from benefiting from the peaceful uses of nuclear energy. This is far more easily said than done. Iran and its six negotiating partners are all parties to the 1970 Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. This treaty was a compromise between the five countries that had nuclear weapons in the late 1960s and the rest, which did not. Those that had promised to get rid of them. Those that had not promised not to acquire them. The United States and Russia have held more than 95% of all nuclear weapons worldwide, but have reduced tens of thousands since their Cold War highs. But each side still has some 5,000 in their active inventories. Britain and France have also reduced their much smaller arsenals. China's minimum arsenal is slowly expanding, but none of these three countries has more than a few hundred. Unfortunately, some countries are not party to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Four states outside the treaty have nuclear weapons: Israel, India, Pakistan, each may have around 100, and North Korea may have a few. These countries generate concerns that they will either use their weapons or provide them to others. Iran's nuclear program poses a different kind of proliferation concern. Even though Tehran denies seeking nuclear weapons and argues against their utility and morality, it has the capability now to build them. The crux of the Iran nuclear problem is the dual-use nature of many nuclear activities. Although developing an industrial infrastructure to enrich uranium is one of the most significant technological obstacles to developing nuclear weapons, enriching uranium is not explicitly prohibited for any Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty members. Five non-nuclear weapon states, parties to the treaty, in addition to Iran, have this capability. For Iran, asserting what it calls its inalienable right, enrichment is the principal pillar of its negotiating position. An explanatory word is an order on uranium enrichment. Uranium in its natural state contains a very small percentage of the fissile isotope U-235. In order to use uranium to fuel nuclear power reactors, that percentage needs to be significantly increased to 3.5%. This is very difficult and requires an elaborate high-tech infrastructure. For example, an ability to build and operate centrifuges with specialty metals that can spin at very high speeds. But once such a capacity has been developed for producing low-enriched uranium, most of the distance has been traveled for enriching to the 90% concentration level required for nuclear weapons. Although the higher the level of enrichment achieved, the easier it is to produce fissile material for nuclear weapons, there are no hard and fast treaty prohibitions on enrichment levels for peaceful activities among the non-nuclear weapon states. The Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty does not rule out reactors using 20% enriched uranium to produce medical isotopes which is what Iran has been doing. The treaty does not even rule out naval propulsion reactors using 90% enriched uranium, the same enrichment level used for the core of nuclear weapons, because naval propulsion is considered a peaceful activity. For some reason, the U.S. and Russia didn't focus on this very much when we were producing weapons-grade uranium to propel our ballistic missile submarines. It's up to the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, to negotiate safeguards agreements with parties to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which help it to determine the accuracy of those states' declarations and to verify the exclusively peaceful nature of their nuclear activities. Most countries using nuclear power buy their fuel from abroad. But for whatever reason, Iran, during the Shah's time and afterward, has been determined to develop a domestic uranium enrichment capacity. And here is the rub. Iran has behaved suspiciously with regard to implementing its safeguards obligations. It has not always provided timely notification of plans for constructing new nuclear-related facilities. It has not cooperated fully in IAEA investigations of possible military dimensions of past Iranian nuclear activities. It has developed a uranium enrichment capability and accumulated enriched uranium stockpiles greatly disproportionate to the fuel needs of its existing and planned nuclear power reactors. It has not accepted enhanced IAEA inspection rights under the additional protocol. It has not ratified the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. The U.S. intelligence community determined in a 2007 estimate that Iranian military entities had been working under government direction to develop nuclear weapons up until the fall of 2003. An IAEA Director General's report in November 2011 told a similar story, adding that it could not rule out that some relevant activity was continuing. The joint November 24th plan of action to resolve Iran nuclear issues kicked in last Monday. During a six-month interim phase, Iran will freeze, or in some cases, roll back uranium enrichment activities and heavy water reactor construction, addressing both the uranium and plutonium routes to acquiring fissile material for weapons. It will also accept a much enhanced inspections regime by the IAEA in exchange for an easing of peripheral sanctions on petrochemicals and allowance of transactions in precious metal exchanges and certain spare parts. The interim phase will leave Iran's nuclear infrastructure and the international community's core sanctions intact, but will provide a breathing space for negotiating a comprehensive and long-lasting solution. The IAEA has already confirmed that Iran has halted production of 20% enriched uranium and begun diluting its existing 20% stockpile. Iran has also halted major work on the Arak heavy water project, which has the potential to produce spent fuel from which plutonium could be extracted. The payments of $4.2 billion in frozen Iranian funds will be released to Iran in monthly increments on condition that Iran is adhering to the terms of the agreement. Moreover, if it does not, the limited sanctions relief can also be quickly suspended. These and other steps in the interim phase mean that by July, Iran will be farther from potentially acquiring a nuclear weapon than it is today. In other words, several weeks will have been added to the amount of time that it would theoretically take Iran to produce enough weapons-grade uranium for one nuclear weapon. And the sides will have established a track record to build confidence in their good faith implementation of future agreements. A surprising threat now looms over implementation of the joint plan's interim phase, a bill in the U.S. Senate. The bill is co-authored by Robert Menendez of New Jersey and Mark Kirk of Illinois, and is co-sponsored by well over half of the Senate, including by Senator Susan Collins of Maine. The bill would impose new sanctions, then provide the option of a presidential waiver, but only if he could certify at periodic intervals that Iran had not conducted certain actions, not only in the nuclear realm, but including terrorism and ballistic missile testing, neither of which were part of the November 24th agreement. Both the U.S. administration and the Iranian government have said that passage of such a bill would sabotage chances of continuing to implement the first phase and to reach a final deal. 10 Senate committee chairs and a dozen of their colleagues, including Maine's junior senator Angus King, have reached similar conclusions. King, by the way, has an op-ed with Senator Levin in today's New York Times, reiterating this argument and saying pretty much what Mac DeFord said in a Rockland Free Press piece last Thursday. So why is Maine's senior senator and so many of her colleagues co-sponsoring a bill which threatens to derail the most hopeful development in a decade wrestling with the Iran nuclear issue? I know that "Get Tough with Iran" is a good bumper sticker for any politician's car, but I can't accept the sponsor's cover story, which is they're just trying to help the president by strengthening his hand in the negotiations and letting the Iranians know how bad things can get if they don't cooperate. There are several reasons why I don't buy this rationale. The Senate Intelligence Committee, on which Senator Collins serves, has said publicly that passage of the bill is likely to make a successful conclusion of the negotiations less likely. The committee's chair, Senator Dianne Feinstein, has strongly opposed passage of the bill. It would appear that momentum behind the bill is starting to flag, but that a majority of senators could still endorse its provisions is very troubling and bodes ill for negotiating a comprehensive deal in coming months. Three aspects of the bill are especially worrisome. The first issue is trustworthiness. The joint plan of action was agreed to after frequent consultations with our five negotiating partners and multiple rounds of intense talks with the Iranians. The Menendez bill moves the goalposts by violating that agreement's letter and spirit and introducing requirements for Iranian action that have been outside of the issues tabled during the negotiations. To build a necessary level of confidence for a final agreement, the implementation of the interim phase measures must be scrupulous and exact. This applies to both sides of the table and includes the United States. The second issue is the shape of the final deal. We need to have constraints on Iranian nuclear activities that increase confidence Iran's program is peaceful and that the verification regime is adequate to provide many months of warning if Iran chooses to break out of its treaty commitments and build a bomb. To reduce Iran's potential to produce fissile materials for weapons, the six powers must focus on rolling back the overall capacity of Iran's enrichment program. This could be accomplished by reducing the scope of Iran's capacity from 19,000 installed centrifuges at two sites today to 3,000 or fewer operating first-generation machines at one site, significantly increasing the time necessary to produce enough highly enriched uranium for one bomb. But requiring Iran to capitulate by dismantling all of its nuclear infrastructure and completely abandoning all enrichment of uranium would not be tolerated by the supreme leader of the Iranian Republic. President Rouhani knows that such an outcome would doom any prospect his team might have for future reforms in either Iranian foreign or domestic policy. It is a formula instead for ending negotiations and forcing war. The third issue is ownership of congressional war powers. The bill contains a sense of the Senate language about supporting Israel militarily if it feels compelled to attack Iran, and this implies a war power authority delegation by the U.S. Senate to another foreign country. The United States should stand squarely behind the defense of Israel, but encouraging Israeli military action under the present circumstances, when we have finally achieved serious negotiations, would be the height of irresponsibility. The negotiations ahead will be very difficult. President Obama puts their chances at 50-50. The deputy Iranian negotiator rates them lower. Gary Seymour, a member of Obama's National Security Council in his first term, says that an agreement in the next 6 months is extremely unlikely. I am more hopeful. The Iranian public is weary of economic hardship and isolation and is still suffering from the trauma of its 8-year total war with Iraq. The last thing the U.S. public wants is to be thrown into another war in the Middle East, bigger and more dangerous than the two previous ones. The presidents residing in Washington and Tehran have one important thing in common. Both want to find a mutually acceptable compromise. And the U.S. and Iranian negotiating teams are just about as good as it gets. Moreover, the six powers opposite Iran at the negotiating table have maintained solidarity in spite of the obviously differing perspectives they bring to the process. And this limits Iran's ability to divide and conquer in the negotiations. Iran does not have to be convinced that the U.S. Congress will come down hard with new sanctions on any signs that the Iranians are not negotiating in good faith. Instead, Congress has to be convinced to back up rather than to backstab the efforts of U.S. negotiators to craft a realistic and acceptable solution. Rather than tie the president's hands, the Congress should make sure he has the authority to unwind sanctions when the final deal is made. Thank you.
Hey, Greg, thank you very much. You've made what is an incredibly complicated and complex situation much clearer. So I'm sure we've got some very good questions. We'll start with this one. What do you think is behind Senator Collins signing on to the Menendez bill? It's always good to get an out-of-state perspective on what our senators are doing.
I have to admit, this is going to be speculation because I do not know. I tried to reach her office on Friday and say, I'm going up to Maine. I'm going to say some things you might think are unflattering about Senator Collins' sign on to this bill. I would like to hear your side of the story. I never was contacted back. My take is that Senator Collins and a lot of others who signed on to this bill were not thoroughly briefed on everything contained by the bill. They thought that this was kind of an easy thing to do. The American-Israeli Political Action Committee certainly felt strongly about the senators signing on to it. The opposition by AIPAC can make trouble for a U.S. senator, even in a place like Maine. As I said in my remarks, Iran and being anti-Iranian is not something that's going to lose you a lot of votes in the American electorate. So all of those things play a role, and one might also add that all but two Republicans in the Senate have also signed on as co-sponsors of the Menendez bill. So it's if you're a Republican senator, it's sort of what you do. Now, for me, that's still a little disappointing because both Senator Collins and I think Olympia Snowe, who I observed a lot as a staffer on the Intelligence Committee for 4 years, have a reputation for being thoughtful and somewhat more independent than some of their Republican colleagues. So I'm disappointed and mystified, and I hope that we will get more clarity on that point in the days ahead.
Okay, we've got a couple of questions about Saudi Arabia. One is, do we have to worry about Saudi opposition to any U.S.-Iran accord? In other words, what can the Saudis, we know they're against it, but what can they do about it?
And on this question, I'm going to defer to Mac DeFord. I'm not an expert on Saudi Arabia. I would say this, though, that we have gotten strong urgings by Saudi Arabia and Israel to toughen up our position in the negotiations with Iran. Both of these countries seem very eager for a very tough U.S. position, and neither one of them seems to object to the U.S. Going to war with Iran, destroying his capabilities militarily. They can have their position, but I would argue that such a war would not be in the interests of either of those countries, and I would think that the Saudis might have a little bit of fear of the street reaction of the U.S. Going to war again against another country in the Middle East for the temerity of having a nuclear program, particularly if one of the partners in the war is a country that has 100 nuclear weapons, the only country in the Middle East that has nuclear weapons. And one might even add the only country which poses an existential threat to the state of Iran.
Okay, here's one about Israel's lack of support. What, in your opinion, would it take for Israel? What could we do to make Israel or encourage Israel to be supportive of the U.S. Iran rapprochement?
One of the first things we could do is to stop equating Israel with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. There is a lot of criticism within Israel of Netanyahu's hardline position on the November 24th joint plan of action. He called it a historic mistake. A lot of his colleagues, even some of them in government, say that this is in Israel's interest that an agreement was reached, and that it is the thing that has to happen if we're going to have a chance of avoiding either another war in the Middle East or an Iran with nuclear weapons. So I think, first of all, we have to understand that Netanyahu is not always reflecting the views of all security figures in Israel. There's a very long collection of former heads of Israeli intelligence, in fact, who have taken public positions in opposition to Netanyahu's reading of the negotiations with Iran. So that would be step number one. And then step number two, I think, is to say that Israel can have its interests and pursue them. The United States has its interest, and our interests are not always going to be necessarily the same as Israel. And we can be both a friend and a defender of Israel without assuming that Israel's definition of our interest is what they are. We will define our interests.
Okay, now I've got a technical question, which I hope I get right. Could triggering mechanisms, which the questioner says are very complex devices for nuclear weapons, could these mechanisms somehow be banned so Iran or others could develop non-weapons of mass destruction since they are prevented from having triggering mechanisms?
Well, if we're talking about I think the question relates to the way one technically triggers a nuclear explosion once you have the fissile material, and the work on such trigger mechanisms is banned under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and everything about that is essentially banned. I mean, any components that goes into it, any activities are banned. So we already have that that prohibition, and there it's a question of trying to make sure that you see this work going on. There is one outstanding historical question we have now. It's called the past military dimensions of Iran's program, and it really relates to the work that Iran may have done before 2003, exploring how one actually triggers a nuclear explosion. So this is not a question of needing to prohibit something that's not prohibited. It's a question of being able to verify non-activity and to be able to figure out if the activity did take place in the past, how do you ensure that it doesn't take place in the future?
Okay, here's also something of a technical question. Under the Nuclear Proliferation, Non-Proliferation Treaty, can Iran sell enriched uranium to other countries? Do some countries sell enriched uranium? Is that legal?
Yes, it is legal to sell enriched uranium if you're selling it at the power reactor level of enrichment. And in fact, most countries that operate nuclear power reactors buy enriched fuel from other countries. Now, this gets into, though, a very important future issue. What kind of future do we envision at the end of the day for an Iran that reaches an agreement? Do we say that an Iran can only enrich uranium for its own reactors, or does it have the ability to enrich uranium fuel and sell it to other countries who are members in good standing of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty? Now, this is a completely unresolved issue. I think among people who follow this issue closely, there is a real difference of opinion about how long this agreement we're now negotiating, this final solution, this comprehensive agreement, how long does it last? And the Iranians say that, and it's really embedded in the language of the November 24th agreement, that Iran will not be forever a pariah. That is, there will be an end time to this comprehensive agreement, that sometime in the future, Iran will be treated like every other Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty member in good standing. So exactly how long that period is, whether it's 10, 20, 30 years into the future, and what that end state looks like, and will there be any kind of other special obligations for Iran, is something that's, I think, still very much up in the air.
Okay, this is a question, Greg, that you may have answered during your talk, but maybe you want to expand on it. How genuine do you believe Iran's interest is in a real deal?
That's one of the hardest questions to answer. What do the Iranians really want? And one of the problems in answering, of course, is that Iran is not North Korea. There is not a leader. The supreme leader is supreme, but he's not a Kim Jong-un who can just easily execute his uncle without any consultations. The supreme leader is not an absolute dictator as in other countries. So what the collective Iran wants in terms of its nuclear future is, I think, a very debatable proposition. I mean, I think we all have to guess at that. I think a lot of Iranians, and perhaps the majority wish in the clerical government, is to have their cake and eat it too, or some would say have their yellow cake and eat it too, to make it nuclear. That is, they would like to remain a member of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty as a non-nuclear weapon state. They would like to have that sort of good citizenship stamp as an international citizen of the world. They would like to be able to continue arguing, as they do today vehemently, that nuclear weapons, either owning them, developing them, possessing them, using them, is un-Islamic. It's haram, it's against their religion, and immoral. And noting that the countries that have these weapons are immoral countries like the United States. So they want to maintain that position. At the same time, have such a well-developed nuclear infrastructure that they are perceived to be a virtual nuclear weapon state, a state that could actually build and deploy nuclear weapons very quickly. And so that they are treated much like we treat other nuclear weapon states, very carefully. To me, that's one of the most plausible speculations about a majority opinion within the current government of Iran. But Iran is a big, complicated country, and I think there is certainly a range of opinion. There are certainly members of the IRGC, the Republican Guard. There are hardliners in Iran that clearly want to have nuclear weapons. If you can believe opinion polls in Iran, the Iranian public is very much interested in its nuclear program, but the Iranian public is not necessarily interested in getting nuclear weapons. So I leave that in my own mind is somewhat of an open question. What does Iran really want? I take the current government of Iran at its word that they would be satisfied in getting a agreement that they have an ability to continue enriching uranium, even if it is somehow limited in amount and kind of enrichment capabilities they have. But as long as they feel that they have some independence from the supply and the dictates of foreign powers. So I do not think that a non-nuclear weapons Iran is something that the current Iranian regime feels that it cannot accept. At the same time, if we keep threatening Iran and keep threatening to attack Iran, we may be able to get them to think differently about the utility of nuclear weapons.
So here's something of a follow-up question. How much support do you think that Rouhani has in Iran? And the opposite, how strong are the Iranian hawks, those who oppose any deal on nuclear weapons?
I listen an awful lot to Iranian experts these days, people who are either Iranian Americans or Iranians, people who are academic scholars on Iran, and there seems to be a consensus that Rouhani has some leash, if I can use that metaphor, from the Supreme Leader to negotiate an agreement with the parties in these talks, but he does not have carte blanche to negotiate anything he wants, and he does not have an unlimited amount of time. There seems to be conventional wisdom in Washington among people who follow this issue closely, that he has about 1 year to wrap this up. And if he doesn't get an agreement, or if we're in some really protracted process of Iranian perceptions that we're negotiating in bad faith and we're dragging out the negotiations, he will be reined in by the Supreme Leader, and he will become ineffectual in his last couple of years as president, as in fact Ahmadinejad, his predecessor, was when he lost faith from the Supreme Leader. So I think Rouhani has a limited amount of time. So far, so good, in that indications are that the people who elected him think that he is carrying out his election mandate of trying to work out a deal with the West, getting Iran out from under sanctions, but that there is clearly resistance to the track that he is on. He has been criticized by hardliners in Iran. The Majlis, the Iranian parliament, in response to this bill that I was complaining about, has said that they are going to introduce a bill to ramp up Iranian enrichment levels to 60%, and kind of a direct retaliation at the threat of new sanctions on the part of the U.S. So there's a real battle going on there. It would be interesting to ask an Iranian, well, what do you think the U.S. really wants? And then we would have to try to speculate on some amalgam of the U.S. government that includes the legislative branch and the executive branch, and what do we really want? It's probably confusing outside the country.
That's a great analogy. All right, here's also a similar question. What is the current U.S. intelligence communities, what is their opinion about Iranian views, popular, the man in the street views of the United States?
I don't have my top secret clearance anymore, so I don't know how to answer that question. But based on my reading between the lines, I was struck by the fact that the intelligence community was willing to say on an unclassified level that what it thought the impact of passing this bill would be on this the prospects for success. So I believe that from what I have heard in discussions that the U.S. Understanding of the Iranian public opinion is pretty much what I had said a few minutes ago, that there is strong Iranian support of a continuation of the Iranian nuclear program, that they very much associate that with their independence and their pride of being Iranian, their symbolic strength as a technological power, their rightful role in the region and so forth, but there is not a strong constituency for Iranian nuclear weapons. And one has to assume that the continuing effects of the Shia clerics saying that Iranian nuclear weapons, I'm sorry, that nuclear weapons in general are sinful and un-Islamic, at least affects some part of the Iranian population. The people saying that may be cynical, but I think it's wrong to assume that everyone that they're saying it to hears it cynically. So it's not a situation as existed in Pakistan when the Pakistani prime minister said that his people eat grass if they have to in order to be able to afford developing a nuclear weapons. Entirely different situation.
Okay, here's a question that's written by one of our former 1960s SDS members. I'll interpret it, I'll read it first. Don't you agree that the schoolyard bully, also known as the United States, has no right to dictate to others what they cannot do when we're doing what we preach against? Now, the interesting aspect of that question is, isn't there something in the Iranian psyche as they look at who said that the United States could be the decider as to what Iran can or cannot do? How important an element is that in the whole thing?
Well, I never joined the SDS, and I thought they were far too radical when I was a student. But I would say that I am rather uncomfortable by our talk about keeping the military option on the table, that if the negotiations don't succeed, we will, of course, have to attack Iran. We got into this mindset, really, after 9/11 and when the George W. Bush administration changed U.S. military doctrine for the first time in the spring of 2002, said that the U.S. now was justified in waging preventive war against countries that might, at some time in the future, develop WMD. That is skating on very thin ice, looked at from a legal perspective. It says nothing about whether or not the Security Council, the UN, justifies an attack. It is the kind of mindset that got us into the war with Iraq when, you may recall, President Bush told the nation that Iraq might have nuclear weapons in 5 years, and we couldn't wait for the mushroom cloud. Well, I spent a lot of time in the intelligence community doing assessments, and I believe that intelligence assessments about future events always have a certain level of uncertainty about them. And traditionally in the United States, we held preventive war to be automatically illegal. Preemptive war could be legal, that is to say, if you had very high confidence that an attack on your country was imminent, you had a right under international law to defend yourself and to strike first. But the idea that because of something that may happen 4 or 5 years into the future, you have a right to respond militarily and attack another country is something that I think is highly dubious. So I wouldn't go too far down the road of the U.S. as bully, however, because for the most part, we are not a country that attacks other countries first. And we have legitimate grievances against countries that are not abiding completely by their commitments under international agreements. And I think that we have to take our lumps if other countries can accuse us of inadequate compliance with treaties. And you may notice that I cited the fact that Iran has not verified the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty as one indication of suspicion. What I didn't say was the United States has not verified the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty that we successfully helped convince the international community was very necessary, as if our over 1,000 nuclear weapon tests weren't quite enough for us. We have to retain that option. I mean, why have we not ratified this convention? So I'm all in favor of being ready for the charge that we are somewhat hypocritical, and I think we better have a good answer for that.
That's an interesting response. All right, Greg, from your intelligence contacts in Washington, is there any sign that Rouhani is Iran? Are they inclined to alter Iranian support for Syria's Bashar al-Assad?
That's another difficult question. Not in the near term, I would think, but I think Rouhani has potential. Clearly, he has put as his first order of business getting a nuclear deal with the six countries that are negotiating with him. And he has not done much in the way of human rights reforms in Iran. He has not done much to curb Iranian support for terrorist activities or for Iranian support to Syria. But one, I think realistically, if one assumes that Rouhani would like a foreign policy that is more responsible, more reasonable, that he can't do everything at once. And he has a lot of opposition, and he has to be careful about overloading the kind of things that are risky for him to do. All of which is to say that I actually think that if we could get this nuclear deal, if we could have a better relationship with Iran, and if, by the way, we would allow Iran to be at the table discussing Syria's future, that we would have a chance to get the Iranians to agree to curtail their support for Assad. I think that is possible. And we have some evidence that even this clerical government of Iran can do the kind of things that we would like to have done. In the case of Afghanistan, it was Iran, according to the chief U.S. negotiator, that in December 2001 was the critical agent in getting the Bonn Agreement on Afghanistan's future. Iran, of all countries. That they made the critical difference in us getting an agreement. But now, unfortunately, our position at the moment is that we can't have Iran at the table because Iran doesn't accept a future without Assad, which is, to me, as a former diplomat, kind of crazy thinking. I mean, you know, you don't just negotiate with people you like and with whom you have no problems. The whole idea is you get to an agreement by talking to the people that you have problems with. So I hope that position will soon change, and if we engage the Iranians diplomatically, if we show that Iran, that diplomatic engagement with the U.S. can serve its own interests on occasion, then I think there's a chance to have the kind of hopeful future that we all want in Syria.
Yeah, some great questions and also some very, very good answers, Greg. Here's our last one. And this is also going to make you think about why we take the position we do towards Iran. Why is our response to Iran's possible nuclear ambition so much more drastic than our posture towards North Korea?
Well, Boy, that's a very good question. Cynics would say that North Korea has accomplished its objectives, that it has tamed the American threat by developing nuclear weapons and therefore proved the very thing that we want to disprove, that nuclear weapons actually do enhance your security, at least with regard to another nuclear weapon state like the United States. The United States is much more cautious with North Korea now than it needed to be before North Korea developed nuclear weapons. I'm not quite willing to embrace that position. North Korea is really sui generis. It's a very unusual state with an unusual government that does not, in many cases, play by the rules that we're familiar with in the international arena. But in many other ways, North Korea, in a sense, is contained. The proliferation of nuclear weapons in North Korea does not sort of spill over into the region in quite the same way that imagining a future Iran with nuclear weapons might. I mean, there's a lot of concern about Saudi Arabia, for example, even other countries, Turkey or Jordan. How would they react if they had a hostile Shia nuclear weapon state on the other side of the Gulf? It's a different level of concern. Then another thing is there's no Israel within range of a 2,200 kilometer range ballistic missile from North Korea. And Israel has an enormous impact on the way we think about security issues in the Middle East. So there are some real differences, but it is a fair question that when we're trying to deal with a proliferation issue in one region of the world, we have to think of the precedential impact of our decisions and our policy on other areas of the world. And one thing that I would just mention that to leave you with is the impact of our nuclear agreement with the state of India, which is one of those countries that never signed the nuclear non-proliferation treaty, and now we agreed to sell India nuclear technology and do other things, which has had an enormously long shadow into all kinds of other issues. Pakistan obviously says, why India and not us? I mean, we deserve the same kind of benefits you're extending. Other countries like Brazil in the world say, wait a minute, we gave up the nuclear option in order to be a good non-nuclear weapon state member of the NPT, even though we see that treaty as being discriminatory. And now you're treating India, you're rewarding India in a way you're not even rewarding us. And they violated all the rules that you want us to operate under. So we do have to think globally when we do things. And I think certainly a lot of our thinking about a future Iranian nuclear arrangement has to think about how other countries in the world will look at that arrangement. Will Iran be perceived as being rewarded for bad behavior in the same way that some people look at the agreements reached with other countries?
Okay, that was supposed to be the last question, but there's one, and this will only take 30 seconds, there's one question here that I thought was very interesting. The questioner says, I'd be interested to know how many people in this room support Senator Susan Collins' idea that we should add additional sanctions on Iran at this point, if they could raise their hands. Greg, you've been incredibly convincing. Thank you very much. For our radio audience, not a single hand went up. Senator Collins, I hope you heard that. Hey, Greg. Greg, come back. This is the famous presentation. You won't be the first person in Washington to have this, though you may be the first person with the Arms Control Association. I'm sure you've heard all about it. It's the famous Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations mug. Thank you very much. It was great.